Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It's a minute before 10 o'clock Eastern Time, a minute before 7 in Northern California, where they're waking up to yet another day of catastrophic fires. The numbers just keep going up, with more than 3,500 homes and businesses destroyed, 24 people known dead, about 180 missing. At last report, the California fire chief says it's going to get worse before it gets better. And the powerful are not immune. The Sonoma County Supervisor, Susan Gorin, is among those whose homes have been destroyed. What an unprecedented time this feels like, with like a series of plagues being visited on the world, right? Historically ruinous hurricanes, historically ruinous fires, the Las Vegas massacre, more frequent acts of political terrorism, and let's be honest, many Americans would say the Trump presidency being visited upon the nation. But oh yeah, people chose that of their own free will in the Electoral College vote. But let's talk about the fires with Julie Johnson, whose title is cannabis reporter at the Press Democrat in Sonoma County, California. She's covering the fires generally. And Philip Bump, Washington Post reporter in D.C., who posted an article called "Clinton Says Wildfires Are Exacerbated by Climate Change. Research Says She's Right." We'll also talk to Philip Bump about other Washington developments. And it's starting off as quite a day, with the president threatening to pull emergency workers out of Puerto Rico sooner rather than later, Energy Secretary Perry pushing new public subsidies for the oil and coal industries, and the president apparently getting ready to attack the Obamacare health exchange marketplaces without Congress passing any such law. So, Philip, welcome back. And Julie Johnson, welcome to WNYC. We appreciate some time from you early in the morning in Sonoma County and in the midst of your emergency situation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And hi, Philip. Thanks for coming back on.
Of course.
Julie, I got that California fire chief prediction from your Twitter feed. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Who is the fire chief, and what do they mean by that?
Well, what they mean by that is that these fires are completely uncontrolled, meaning they don't have those lines around them, those containment lines that they need in order to really start working to put them out and deal with trouble spots. So none of these fires have any meaningful containment, 2% maybe. What we really want to see today, if they could get to 20%, that would just feel like, okay, we're getting somewhere, but we're not even close.
What makes these fires so hard to control?
The terrain here is very rugged. We've got this urban-rural interface. It gets rugged very quickly. It's steep. It's craggy. It's dry as can be. There are these, oak trees that just look like they're matchsticks. They could light up at any second. The understory is incredibly dry. We're just coming off years of drought. It's arguable whether we're actually out of the drought. And we have many homes that pepper these areas, and then they very quickly get into urban spaces. So it's just very dangerous.
Where are all the people going whose homes are being destroyed? Thousands of people.
Yeah, they're flooding out of the area. I know the beaches have been packed, the Northern California beaches, but people are going to Petaluma. There are shelters all over the place, and I know they're about two-thirds capacity. I talked to someone who was going to the Sierra. I've talked to people who are going down to Marin County to the south of here. They're just kind of finding any place, any people, other family members within a drive. They're going anywhere they can.
Your area of Northern California is sometimes called wine country. Here in New York, we hear it referred to by that a lot these days, the fires in wine country. But your title is cannabis reporter. So how much is it also weed growing country, and how much of an actual industry is that in California?
Well, it is. Marijuana is a historic crop here, albeit an underground one. And, these fires come up just at harvest. It's grape harvest and it's the cannabis harvest. And so both of those industries which play a huge role here, are, you know, facing some major difficulties. And specifically for marijuana farmers, because they are trying to legitimize the industry now with a whole set of statewide regulations, people were relying on this harvest to get the money that they need in order to spend all the money they need to do to improve infrastructure, buy the permits that they need to make those investments to become a legitimate industry, you know, make the ADA improvements they need to. And I think for many, they're not going to get that money that they need, and they don't have access to loans. So, you know, I don't want to overplay. There's so many people affected by this, but certainly it couldn't come at a worse time for marijuana farmers.
Listeners in the New York area who are originally from Northern California, north of San Francisco, or know anybody out there who you've been in touch with, call us and help report this story or ask questions of our guests. Julie Johnson from the Sonoma County Press. Sorry, I lost your newspaper title. What is it? Press Democrat, sorry.
Press Democrat, yeah.
Or Philip Bump from the Washington Post in Washington, D.C. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So to Philip Bump in Washington. Philip, sorry, you're with the Washington Post, but you're based in New York. I'm getting all these things wrong this morning. I see that you have this article that says Clinton says wildfires are exacerbated by climate change. Research says she's right. Why is Hillary Clinton talking about this? And tell us about this research.
So Clinton was talking about it. She was at an appearance as part of her book tour at UC Davis in the northern part of the state. And she mentioned the wildfires, obviously, that were, there was a wildfire burning probably about 20 miles southwest of where she was speaking. She looped that in with the hurricanes as a part of a broader point about climate change. But it's a point that I think is worth highlighting. There has been a lot of research done, obviously, about what the anticipated effects of climate change are going to be. In that research, there is specifically this anticipation that there will be bigger and more rapidly burning wildfires in the future as a result of climate change. And it's interesting to see the pattern of what happened in California this year as sort of instructive. So as was just mentioned, there had been this long drought in California. But then over the course of the winter, it was the rainiest winter ever in the state of California on record. And that led to a lot of vegetative growth. But then we also had the hottest summer on record in California, which meant that all that growth then dried out. And so we saw a lot of fires in June and July, late June, that were that vegetation burning. We see here, too, that that is contributing to the problem. At the same time, there are these winds that come down from Nevada and Utah called Diablo winds that helped pick up the fire and helped it spread very quickly. Those winds, too, as Eric Holthaus noted at Grist, those winds, too, are expected to become worse because of climate change. There are all these ways in which these things overlap.
Julie, it's ironic that California leads the country in state-level carbon emission rules, but one state on its own can't stop climate change. Are people talking about this there, or is now just not the time, and people just need to save their homes and save their lives as much as possible?
Yeah, people are so focused on the immediate, and we're all looking at the sky and feeling it in our lungs. I'm sure that will be conversation later.
Phil, the president tweeted this morning that emergency workers can't stay in Puerto Rico forever, but I haven't seen any tweets yet sympathizing or offering federal help or anything yet for Northern California. Does his silence say anything in and of itself?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things we've seen is that Donald Trump is a lot more receptive to statements of support for places that have supported him politically. And I don't know if that plays a role in California, but I think it plays a role in his response to Hurricane Harvey in Texas and in Florida versus Puerto Rico. I think one generally wonders the extent to which, you know, how many of these things that are going on in the world are on Trump's radar screen at any one time. And I think he's so immersed in both trying to defend himself on Puerto Rico and trying to fight this culture fight on the NFL that he doesn't have a whole else lot that he's paying attention to.
Julie, does California need federal help? We saw how Washington responded to Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico, even if controversially about how much. Do you need federal assistance there? I mean, actual, you know, boots on the ground or firefighting helicopters in the air or whatever that's federally deployed beyond what the state and the counties have?
We do, and some of it is here already. I heard over the police radio last night, as darkness fell, I heard them say the National Guard is here, and they're all bilingual, which is amazing and wonderful and needed, particularly in the Sonoma Valley. And I know that there have been disaster declarations that open up FEMA to come in. And that kind of assistance is going to be very important for the recovery process. There are entire neighborhoods who lost their homes. I cannot overstate this. They are gone. And what is the economic impact of having that many people in this area without a home? Not to, you know, and on top of that, they're out of work. The businesses are down. Many have been raised. The wine industry, we'll see how that's impacted. So the long-term recovery process is really where I think that the federal assistance will be beneficial.
Barton in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Thank you. You there, Brian?
Yeah, Barton, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I think he can't hear me. I know we can hear him. All right, Barton, hang on a second. Pick him up on hold there and see if we can fix whatever that problem is. Let's see if Camille in Manhattan's line is working any better. Camille, you're on WNYC. Can you hear me?
Hi, this is Camille. How are you? You hear me okay?
I hear you fine. Go ahead.
You know, thanks so much for taking my call. And, you know, I said three things to the screener. One, I'm incensed that this president, so-called president that we have, has really said not a word about what I believe to be the seventh largest economy in the world, which is California. I also, you know, my father owns a business, and his home is in Calistoga, which is under mandatory evacuation as of yesterday. So any word that your guests could offer us to the state of that town would be helpful. And thirdly, just a shout out to the firefighters. I think we're accustomed to just thinking these men and women are available and have unlimited resources, but they have to be dog-tired. Many of the people fighting the fires are volunteer departments. I personally went with my family to a pancake breakfast to raise money for just basic equipment for their activities. I don't think people are aware how thin the ranks really are. So I was thrilled to know that more help is on the way. And that's all I have to say.
Camille, thank you so much. I hope everybody you know out there is okay. Julie, of course, first responders are amazing. They run toward danger while everybody else is running away. Their sense of duty and public service leads so many first responders and companies, you know, police departments, fire companies, et cetera, from around the country to step up when other localities need help. Are you getting a lot of personnel from other states, other parts of the country in there to help fight these fires?
We are. The sheriff mentioned this was, you know, maybe day two or day one, that 100 officers showed up from a nearby county and were, you know, there and ready to help. And he had to turn them away, not really turn them away, but postpone their involvement, say, okay, we're going to need you on Wednesday. And it's, you know, I just cannot overstate the amount of work firefighters, first responders, dispatchers, police deputies are doing. I talked to a battalion chief with the Santa Rosa Police or Fire Department yesterday, and his guys had been working since Sunday night. And, you know, the profound effect on these people when this is their homes, the assistant fire marshal, his home is gone, and he's been working tirelessly. I don't know how. The adrenaline must just be flowing. And, you know, I was driving around the Sonoma Valley yesterday in evacuation zones, some advisory, And, you know, there were deputies from Alameda County, from all over the place, state park rangers. They're just everywhere. Everyone is, you know, doing incredible work tirelessly.
Now I think we have Barton in Brooklyn connected. Barton, you're on WNYC. Sorry about before.
That's okay, Brian. Sorry about that. I think climate change is part of the issue, but there's a much larger issue is following some horrific wildfires in the turn of the 1900s. The federal government changed its policy of letting wildfires burn to suppressing them. And by doing that, the dead debris from trees, leaves, and whatever else has accumulated, whereas the fires actually clean up the forest and get rid of that debris. So now you have a much larger fire load. So when a fire starts, you're going to have a lot hotter and more dangerous and faster growing fire. Additionally, with the fires, it's basically Mother Nature's way of rejuvenating the forest. So there are seed pods, I believe, for the giant sequoias, which need a certain amount of heat to open. And fires prior to the change of the policy, the seeds opened and the trees rejuvenated. But now, with the fires being so hot, you get a scorched earth, and it basically destroys the soil, so nothing can grow. The other issue is that people are moving into what the fire service calls wild-urban interface, which is the city is moving into the woods. You there, Brian?
Yes.
Okay. And they're building homes where they shouldn't be. And the National Fire Protection Association has a program where they go into these communities and work with communities to build defensible spaces around the homes so that if there is a fire, the homes won't burn. But unfortunately, people like their trees and their plants and everything around their home. So when the fire starts, these burn and then communicate to their home, they lose
right.
their home.
Urban-rural interface. It sounds, Barton, like you know a lot about this. Do you think the first problem that you raised, the fact that they started a policy of trying to control wildfires, is related to the second? As Northern California became more populated from just being a rural area, there was more of an incentive to keep the fires contained earlier?
I think it is, because I think people didn't understand what the purpose of a fire was and its natural means for cleaning the forest.
Julie Johnson, are people talking about this as a policy issue, you know, over the years in your area?
Yeah, it has been a topic of conversation, absolutely, and especially we've had these huge, huge fires the last couple of years where fire activity is unlike, you know, I've heard many, many veteran fire chiefs say, I've never seen fires like this, and that started years ago, particularly up in Lake County, and I'm not sure, there's a lot of debate about, you know, this policy of not letting them burn. You can't let them burn when we have, what he said, this wild urban interface. And, you know, in the 60s, we had a bad fire that traced a similar path to one of the ones here that came into Santa Rosa. But at that time, in 1964, there was not the population that we have now. Now that whole region, it's this mountainous, rugged, beautiful area. You know, you've got big homes, you've got ranches, you've got rural communities studding those mountains, and that is a real challenge when you've got all this dry fuel on the ground.
Barton, anything you want to add before you go?
You there, Brian?
Yeah, we're here. Anything you want to add before you go?
In response to what you're saying is these fires traditionally burn in the same places, and people are building in these areas where they shouldn't be, sort of like floodplains, where people are building along rivers in the oceanfront, and it's basically people have I want to call it an entitlement to live where they want to, which they shouldn't be, and laws need to be changed to prevent people from moving into these areas, and if they do choose to on their own, they need to take the proper precautions and steps to build safely as possible, because it's not worth a firefighter's life to go into a place where someone is building because they want to live there because it's such a beautiful view.
Barton, thank you so much. Like I say, it sounds like you know a lot about this, and I really appreciate you calling. And Ariel in Fort Greene, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ariel.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Okay, thank you.
Good. I was just calling in, listening a little bit to your show. I have a lot of family and friends in Sonoma, where I grew up. Family properties that have been there for four or five generations. And it just seems like it's a very unpredictable situation at the moment. It also seems like there's a lot of information, misinformation. It definitely feels like there's not necessarily a disaster plan for something like this, which is disconcerting being far away from what's happening.
Thank you. And to that point, Julie Johnson, why are people dying in these fires? The last number I saw was 23 dead, 180 people missing. Don't they know the fires are coming?
No. I heard from the president, or I heard about the president of Sonoma State University waking up to her house in flames because it was in an area where the fire came, you know, within, I think, the first couple of hours. Part of the problem, so this fire started in a pretty rural area just north of the main Tubbs fire that was, you know, came into Santa Rosa, started just north of Calistoga, and it raced through these hills. It came, and I'm not sure, we'll figure out the exact timeline, it came into Santa Rosa so fast. These fires move so fast, and it's not like it's moving in one contiguous, neat little line. They're throwing embers, they're starting spot fires ahead of them, and this fire event was made possible by 50 to 60 mile an hour winds that were just pushing the flames forward, throwing embers. You know, I think a lot of people in those areas do have defensible space, but in the line of that kind of inferno, it's not going to do you any good. But I was, you know, watching firefighters work in areas once the fire has kind of slowed down. They're able to really save homes when they have, you know, mowed the understory down to dirt and, you know, limbed the trees and, you know, clean the gutters and do all those things that you just have to do when you live in that environment.
Julie Johnson, we're going to let you go, and we're going to stay with Philip Bump from The Washington Post. Julie Johnson from the Sonoma County Press Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can stay safe out there.
Thank you.
And Phil, Trump this morning, as The Washington Post frames it in a story that people probably haven't heard yet because it's so new, sought to shame Puerto Rico for its own plight. He tweeted, "Electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes." And he quoted Cheryl Atkinson, a television journalist, as saying, "Puerto Rico survived the hurricanes. Now a financial crisis looms largely of their own making." There was a threat contained in these tweets to pull FEMA out, pull other emergency workers out. What's going on?
Right. So what's going on is a tricky question that I'm not sure I can answer. But yes, Donald Trump this morning essentially said, hey, at some point we just got to call it a day on Puerto Rico, which is both unusual for a president to say in the wake of a natural disaster that hit a part of the United States.
That's still still ongoing, by the way, and still in the life-saving mode.
Absolutely. I mean, 80% of the island still doesn't have power. More than a third still doesn't have water. But, you know, it's also stark contrast to the way that he responded after Hurricane Harvey. I mean, it's a totally unrealistic expectation, as Peter Baker from the New York Times pointed out. The federal government was in the New Orleans region for 7 years after Katrina, still doing cleanup, still trying to help people recover from that. I went to Staten Island earlier this year to see what advice they might have for people affected by Harvey. There's parts of Staten Island that still are being rebuilt that are still uninhabited after Sandy hit in 2012. So he's setting this standard, and I think, and I actually just filed a piece on this, the perception one gets is that Donald Trump likes to punch back at his political opponents, and I think he has started to see this because the media came down on him for his slow response because politicians on the island were critical of him. I think he sees this now as this being a political opponent of his, and I think that makes him less interested in sticking to it and trying to be helpful to them over the long term because he finds them personally frustrating.
As with so many of these Trump things, there's a certain grain of truth somewhere in there. Like, it's not nonsense that if a structural problem existed before the hurricane, you can't keep emergency relief workers there forever to shore it up that way forever, and yet doing it now and doing it in this way is Trumpian vindictiveness and maybe anti-Latino rabble-rousing to his base. And both things are true, but it's the way he does it and it's what he does.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it certainly is the case that Puerto Rico had a significant problem with debt prior to the hurricane hitting. This was something that Congress was trying to figure out how to deal with. They'd been defaulting on debt payments. This was a significant problem. There were infrastructural problems on Puerto Rico. But none of that detracts from the fact that Hurricane Maria obliterated a lot of what was happening on the island, and it needs to be dealt with. And it reinforces the fact that the federal government has an even larger role to play simply because it has more resources than were in place on the island. But because of how this happened, because Donald Trump was not paying a lot of attention to it at the outset and started to once the media was becoming critical, that framed how he views the entire thing.
It seems like he's spinning faster and faster the last few days, if that's even possible. I'm looking at the most read politics articles list on your Washington Post site, and they are number one, he threw a fit. President's anger over Iran deal forced aides to scramble for a compromise. Number two, president escalates threats against the press. That's about him saying maybe NBC should lose its license. By the way, TV networks are not licensed by the government. I'll just throw that in. Number three, pro sports teams were once reliable patrons of Trump hotels, not anymore. And number four, Trump to sign order to eliminate ACA insurance rules, undermine marketplaces. I want to get to the details of that insurance marketplaces one, but it looks like, and I heard NBC reporting this morning that said people around him are saying the president seems increasingly unstable and is lashing out in all directions. Or is this the plan? These are the policies he feels he got elected to carry out because this is what he ran on. Kill the current health insurance law, dismantle the anti-global warming environmental rules, the Iran deal, try to destroy the credibility of the press. Is something new escalating, or is this what he promised and what he's delivering on?
So it seems like the safest answer to that is it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
So there was this great report in Vanity Fair yesterday from Gabriel Sherman, which articulated that a lot of folks that he had spoken with in the White House saw Donald Trump as being increasingly erratic and frustrated. The Post had a good interview with an old friend of his, a businessman named Tom Barak, yesterday, who said the same thing, that this wasn't the Donald Trump that he knew. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, Donald Trump has done a lot of things since he took office to try and undercut Obamacare, obviously advocated for legislation that would undo it pretty significantly, but it's taken a lot of small steps, you know, cutting back on the amount of money advertising enrollment in Obamacare, things like that, with an eye toward doing what he said he was going to do, which was take down Obamacare. So I think we're sort of just reaching this moment where he's obviously frustrated. This isn't the job that he is anticipating it was going to be. It's been a long, hard 9 months, but at the same time, he's still pressing forward and doing the things he promised.
One of your current articles says you think Trump says to readers, you think Trump looks like Putin with his threats against press freedoms? No, he looks more like Erdogan, the president of Turkey. What distinction are you making between Putin and Erdogan that matters to the United States?
Well, I think it's sort of the phase of where they are in their reach towards autocracy, right? So people are pretty familiar with Vladimir Putin, who he is, what he stands for, what Russia is like, Putin's attitude toward the press. And they may be less familiar with Erdogan, who sort of emerged as an autocrat over the course of the last few years, particularly in response to a coup attempt against him last year. But what Erdogan has done is he backed a constitutional referendum, which gave himself more power. He instituted a state of emergency after that coup, which gave him more power. He has cracked down on the press. There are more people, more members of the media imprisoned in Turkey than any other country in the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. And so Erdogan has sort of instituted all of the sorts of things that Donald Trump has said at times that he wants to see, such as, to your point earlier, cracking down on NBC because they did a story that he didn't like. And while Erdogan's been doing all this, while he had literally had his bodyguards beat up American protesters in Washington, D.C. in May of this year, Donald Trump has consistently said he doesn't think that the relationship between Erdogan and himself has ever been closer, that he considers Erdogan a friend. He actually called and congratulated Erdogan after this constitutional vote earlier this year in which he seized more power. So that, I think, is instructive because Erdogan has sort of gone down a path that it seems clear Donald Trump would embrace if he had the ability to.
Isn't it in Turkey where a Wall Street Journal reporter was just convicted of, encouraging terrorism, something like that, and the Wall Street Journal calls it ludicrous? Do you know that situation, and has the Trump administration weighed in on it on behalf of what looks like an American unfairly charged abroad?
Yes, that's right. So that is accurate. Happily, that reporter is actually in New York at this time, so she doesn't actually face the risk of imprisonment at this point. However, that happened, I believe, 2 days ago, literally less than 24 hours before Donald Trump made these new calls to crack down on the press. So, no, I have not seen anything from the White House about that conviction. But what we have seen from the White House is support of similar actions here.
Let's take a Puerto Rico call. Cecilia in Mechanicville, New York. That's north of Albany, right, Cecilia?
Yes, hi.
Thank you so much for calling.
Yes. So I wanted to make a comment in response to the...
Whoops. I don't think we're getting her. Cecilia, you know what? Move to a part of the room where you get a really good cell phone signal. Can you try that? All right. Oh, there you are. Here, let's try it one more time. Cecilia, are you there?
Okay.
Hi, go ahead.
That's good.
Yes. Much better.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling in response to the commentary that Trump's tweets this morning is feeding around Puerto Rico and this narrative that...
And now her line entirely dropped off. So if she gets back with us in the next couple of minutes before we run out of time for the segment, we'll put her back on. But Philip Bump from The Washington Post, on Trump signing an order to eliminate Affordable Care Act insurance rules. Of course, one of the big stories of this year is the Republican Congress trying over and over again to repeal and replace Obamacare and failing because they don't have the votes. What is Trump now trying to do on his own, and is it constitutional?
The constitutional question I'll leave to constitutional scholars and or the Supreme Court. I think that, as I said earlier, this continues a pattern, right? So Donald Trump said we have to repeal and replace Obamacare on the campaign trail. It was pretty apparent before the election, but it became obvious this year that the Republicans didn't have a good strategy, a good policy to put forward to actually do that. They weren't able to pass anything in part because of dissension, actually entirely because of dissension within their own party. But Donald Trump still wants to see something happen, and he is convinced for some reason, and I don't know that this is a safe political gamble for him to make, but he's convinced that if he undercuts Obamacare and it starts to collapse and actually starts to be damaged, that he won't pay a political price for it. And so we've seen him take all of these actions. He has stopped the Department of Homeland of Health and Human Services from partnering with states on encouraging enrollment. He's cut funding for enrollment. He's, even the website to enroll is going down for 12 hours every week during the enrollment period. There are all these things that are being done, including this executive order today, which will change the way in which states are able to offer insurance policies. All these things are going to make Obamacare weaker. And he thinks that will pay off for him over the long run politically.
Mary, did you say caller 9? We have one healthcare call coming in response to this, and let's take it. Doug in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, hello. You were just talking about this subject. I'm very puzzled by this. I don't think there's any legal or constitutional jurisdiction. You can't regulate insurance through an executive order. It's not even, maybe through legislation, federal legislation maybe, but I thought there's a law from the 19th century actually that every state individually regulates their insurance companies. It can only be done through a state. It has no relevance to the executive branch of the federal government, certainly. That's what an executive order is about.
Well, that's why I asked the constitutional question before. And of course, Philip, I don't expect you to be a constitutional scholar or play a member of the Supreme Court on the radio, but we know that there have been so many lawsuits against Obama executive orders on DACA and other immigration things, on the clean power rules, without going through Congress. And that's the point of the conservative side lawsuits against Obama. He was doing things that weren't supposed to be in the president's power. They were in the power delegated to Congress, especially after Congress did pass a law on those topics. The president shouldn't seem to undermine those laws on his own without being held to account by the courts. And one could say that that's what's going on in this case.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is an argument. I mean, it certainly is the case that the president does have executive authority to decide how laws get implemented in a lot of regards. Barack Obama did a lot of things on Obamacare, which were executive orders to that end, which conservatives were frustrated by. I expect that when this executive order is signed, it will very quickly be a legal challenge by states, and then that legal challenge will be evaluated by the courts, and it will either be stayed or upheld in fairly short order. So I think we're not going to have to wait very long for an answer to that question. But the broader point, again, is Donald Trump is doing everything he can or everything he thinks he can in order to slow down the advance of Obamacare, which he thinks is to his political benefit.
And I think we have Cecilia, who was calling about Puerto Rico, back on the line. Cecilia, can you hear me? Hi.
Yes, I can. Hi,
how are you?
I'm sorry
about
that.
No problem. Go ahead.
Yes, so I just wanted to comment on the sort of media narrative that Trump is continuing to perpetuate, that the economic crisis in Puerto Rico is, quote-unquote, of Puerto Rico's making. I think that anybody who really analyzes the history of the debt crisis in Puerto Rico can point to U.S. government economic policy that goes back many, many decades. Basically, this is the colonial history of Puerto Rico. And I think it's a really dangerous thing to promote this narrative that we, quote-unquote, brought this on ourselves. And I just really want us to challenge that media narrative.
Thank you very much. And we'll do another segment in coming days that looks, because it's becoming so relevant now with the we were covering anyway the Puerto Rican debt crisis, but now in the wake of the hurricane and with Trump digging in on this position that he tweeted again today, the hurricane only reveals the ongoing lack of Puerto Rico being able to take care of itself, which is basically what he said today. We're going to look in some detail to the roots of the financial crisis there and how varied they are. So that's a promise, Cecilia. Thank you for calling. Before you go, Philip Bump from the Washington Post, kind of on another topic, I see that you wrote an article called "There's an important Political Lesson Buried in the Harvey Weinstein Story," which, of course, we're going to keep covering here for all the horrors and their implications for women in and out of Hollywood, as people are sharing all kinds of their own stories about people who aren't Harvey Weinstein. But there's an important political lesson buried in the Harvey Weinstein story, is your article. What is it?
It is that particularly for high-profile, important political positions like district attorney of the county of New York, the island of Manhattan, there should be a contested race. So Cy Vance Jr., as people are, your listeners better than anyone know, district attorney of Manhattan, he has been criticized in two ways over the past few weeks. First, for dropping criminal charges against Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. related to their apparently, allegedly fraudulent claims around Trump Soho. And then secondarily, because of this Weinstein case, because as I'm sure people are pretty familiar at this point, the NYPD had audio recording essentially of Weinstein admitting to having groped someone, but the DA's office decided not to press charges. There's a lot of nuance there. You know, obviously DA is making a case for why they made the right decision on both of these things, but Cy Vance is up for re-election next month running against nobody. And that means that for essentially his 2013 election will be an eight-year-long election during which voters have had only this moment to weigh in on the job he's doing, and now they don't actually have a chance to do so. There is a push to have a write-in candidacy that opposes him. The odds of that passing are pretty slim, and I think that that's an important lesson for us to learn.
Philip Bump, Washington Post correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.